Hubbard puts up a 3-point shot and he nails it.
Super Wednesday is ours.
Fantastic!
All 33,000 students at the University of Nottingham, they know what this means.
This is URN Sport.
Welcome to the Tuesday Sports Show. It's the 7th of February, and unfortunately tonight we can't go out live because we've had some server issues today, but we'll still be doing the talking part, which I'm sure you'll all enjoy. We'll be discussing the Super Bowl, Davis Cup, Six Nations and the cricket. And tonight I'm joined by Chris, who's on Super Bowl, Naomi, who's on tennis, Jeremy, who's on Six Nations, and Joe, who's on the cricket. But before we go to any of that, we're just going to head over to Naomi right now to talk about the athletics news from yesterday.
Yesterday, we found out that Russia are to remain suspended for the World Athletics Championships in London this summer due to all the doping in the athletics. And some Russians may be able to compete, but it will be under a neutral banner if they can satisfy testing criteria. Obviously, some athletes missed the Rio Olympics last year, but the suspension is due to continue until November. The Russian team was suspended from November 2015, and the suspension is set to continue until November 2017.
Yeah, so guys, what are your thoughts on this?
It's a bit of a hammer blow really to the Russian side. Obviously they've been at the centerpiece of all this like doping that has been happening in athletics. You could argue to a certain extent actually that even though they are the biggest culprits, there still are a lot of teams that do seem to be getting away with it. So I do understand if there's a bit of a grievance with the Russian athletics team, there definitely will be. But I'm not really sure they can argue with it. The only thing I think they can say is, why not anyone else has been banned from this?
Yeah, there might be a case for more teams and more allegations coming out in the future weeks, but I'm sure we'll have to wait and see about that one. And we'll keep you up to date on the athletics news throughout the term. But now we're going to move on to the Super Bowl, and we'll head over to our expert on American football.
Loose term. I would recommend using the term very loosely right now.
We'll go over to Chris.
Thank you very much for that, Harry. It was the most unbelievable Super Bowl of all time, probably, it's got to be said.
Probably.
The fact that... probably, yeah, exactly. You can just see how much of an expert I am on this. The New England Patriots, I should say, led this incredible, unbelievable comeback in the fourth quarter to beat the Atlanta Falcons 34-28 after overtime, having been behind 28-3 with about 8 minutes left to go in the third quarter. It really was absolutely stunning. Atlanta were just brilliant in the first half, it's got to be said to them. They made some great plays, deservedly led by three touchdowns going into the half. The Patriots did manage to get a field goal to make it look as though they were back in contention. And then they got another touchdown. The Atlanta Falcons, really great play from Matt Ryan, who I thought had a wonderful game. And then suddenly the comeback started. Tom Brady I don't know what he said to them, but it was just absolutely incredible. I think a lot of people actually admitted here in the UK that they had gone to bed and missed the fourth quarter, but it was just absolutely astonishing. What was it like? 19 unanswered points in the third quarter or something like the stat was. But yeah, to trail from 25 points and then to record it, to make it 28-28 and then force the overtime, which was the first in Super Bowl history, and then they went on to win it. It really is absolutely astonishing from not just Brady, but the entire New England Patriots setup, and it's their fifth title and Brady's fifth title as well.
Is it one of the best comebacks of all time in any sport? Would you say?
Well, it's the equivalent of like being
It'll probably be put up. I mean, the fact that it's the first ever Super Bowl to go to overtime speaks volumes for how tight and competitive it was, and also how quickly they were able to turn that game around. I can't really say, if there's been a better one in American football Super Bowl history of a comeback due to my own personal very limited knowledge of Super Bowl. But I'd say as a modern example is one we can now think of. Yeah, that's probably one of a really great classic comeback. Not in my opinion, though, the greatest of all time. I've got my own version of that.
It is pretty Istanbul-esque, isn't it?
That's the one!
Yeah, but it's amazing. They were basically the equivalent of being 4-0 down and then went on to win it. Can you imagine, like, if England and were like 28-3 up against like say like New Zealand, you know, you'd be quite happy, you'd be quite confident, and then suddenly to go on to lose that. I do feel for the Atlanta Patriots, the Atlanta Falcons, I should say, sorry, but I think there's two sides to the story. Is that as good as the Patriots were in that third quarter, the Falcons just collapsed. The defense was just so tired, they just didn't have the stamina anymore. And when because the defense looked tired, but even offensively as well, just nothing was really clicking for them. And then by the time it got to overtime, it looked as though there was only going to be one winner, really.
So would you say that Tom Brady is one of the best, the greatest NFL players of all time?
I don't know what the rest of the guys think, but I think after what happened on Sunday evening, it has to be said that he is the greatest of all time. And I think winning,
I'd agree with that, yeah.
Not just winning his fifth title as well, but in the way that he led the team to such an unbelievable comeback, for me personally, does cement his status as the greatest of all time. And that's like being people like Joe Montana, Dan Marino as well. You know, Tom Brady, in my opinion, stands above them.
Okay, so we've talked about the game. How was the overall experience? Did any of you guys watch it?
I wish I watched it.
I watched the first half and then I went to bed.
Did anyone see the halftime show? Was it worth it?
I saw the trailers. I did see quite a few of the trailers that they posted for it. Yeah, afterwards. I mean, it. Super Bowl itself kind of developed as being not just about, obviously, like, it's kind of one of those weird sports where the game like happens in the background. It's something, if it's great, you can talk about it as well, but it's kind of the whole build up, the atmosphere. I mean, last Thursday the guys were on here interviewing the university's own American Football Society, and they were talking about how obviously they rented out, I think it was the Marcus Garvey Hall for like when they where they put it on, and it was, you know, apparently a fantastic atmosphere and a great place to go and watch. So Super Bowl's kind of like moved on now in a way, well, it's kind of in Britain, I'd say. Definitely it's not just about the sport, because honestly I don't think a lot of people really know it in that much detail. It's more kind of like the whole atmosphere and getting into the idea of this is Super Bowl, this is something you want to be involved in.
Yeah, I think just to follow on what Jeremy said, I think it to agree with him, that it is a growing culture in the United Kingdom. You also just see how, I think it's three games are now played in Wembley, and I think Sadiq Khan's actually now quite keen to make it four, just because of how much revenue they actually do bring to the city. But the halftime show itself was, I actually thought was really good, from Lady Gaga. Like, it even got me, like, just, you know, when she was like, poker face, I was like, yeah, like, what a tune. But no, it's...
I'm glad I didn't see that.
Yeah, yeah. Quiet and she listened to Chris on that. Like,
oh, yeah. Well, that was one way of describing it, anyway. But I think just the overall experience, yeah, I think it is true what Jeremy said as well. Like, it's very stop-start. I think the adverts... and watching players just stand around and talk makes up more than half of airtime for the Super Bowl. And I think like maybe like, was it just under 33% or something like that is actual game time. So it is, you're not really there to watch the game, and it's just in itself. There is much more to that. And I think you see like with the culture of like the halftime show and also the commercials as well, that's a really big thing about Super Bowl. It's just this entire thing which... you know, if anything, actually encompasses American culture quite well.
Yeah, it's sort of like a glorified, what the FA Cup final used to be in Britain. We don't really have anything like it in this country, do we?
When Man City win the league, win the cup.
Aguero, that goal, maybe. But no, I don't think we have anything quite like it, and it's quite a big event, isn't it? Do you reckon it'll catch on in the UK at all? I know we've discussed this a bit on the show.
Again, following on from what the guys said last Thursday, it's catching on in university, definitely, because obviously we've got societies that play it, and also, you know, we get students coming in from America as well that kind of bring it over and show how important it is. I mean, it's growing, I think, is what we have to look at it with Super Bowl. It's something that's on the up, but... it is going from a very small beginning, because, I mean, for example, I don't think my... when me growing up, I don't exactly remember much of it really at all. I only really remember that Super Bowl starts to become something big about 5 years ago, really, from that's my memory of it. But I don't know, it's interesting. I think it's definitely getting bigger. But I think it's still a long way off from any of like the sports in the UK that we view as being much more important. You know, rugby, football, the Olympics especially, I think, is one which we view far more important to compare to it. So I don't know, it's one that's growing, but long way to go.
Okay, so that's the end of the American football chat for now. And we're going to move on to Jeremy now with some Six Nations chat. And it was a good weekend for England, wasn't it?
You say that. And that first half against France was not a good weekend. Yeah, okay, looking at it on the long run, the early game of the match was Ireland versus Scotland. That ended in a nail-biting win for Scotland in that game. Really close. To be fair, Scotland played very well, especially in the first half, but Ireland were pretty chronic in that first half as well. It was a case of both Scotland playing well, but Ireland playing abysmally. They fought back in the second half very well, and it looked for a brief period as though they were going to catch the pull it back, but the final penalty that Scotland got just literally as the whistle went for full time sealed a shock victory. You could see it in the fans, the BBC's coverage. You could see, you know, Scottish fans crying because they might not win the wooden spoon this year with that. They might actually do quite well. And to be fair, we did say last week that we thought they could do well, and that was an example of it. So that was beneficial, but. The England-France game, my God, that was a horrible...
It was really disappointing,
first half was literally a game of penalties. It was between Owen Farrell and Daly on one side, and I've forgotten the French kicker's nail to my head.
Camilo Lopez,
that's the one. Literally, see which of those three could get the most number of points from the kicks, and it was just abysmal, really, going into the half-time. England was really pretty poor. Second half came out a lot better. The French got an early try and converted it. But then, personally for me, the actual real impact player, and he came off the bench, was Danny Kerr. And when he was on, it turned that game around. England finally were able to scrape over the line, 19-16. But, I mean, they've got Wales this weekend away.
Do you reckon we can be confident for that, Joe?
I think with England against France, to win when they haven't played well is a big thing. Mm. I think in the past, under different coaches, and there's a game they definitely would have lost.
Stuart Lancaster.
Just saying that.
Under Eddie Jones, you know, they've gone unbeaten all year, and they've won the first game of Six Nations. But if they don't perform better against Wales, I think they could be the end of a defeat, because Wales, although they've been in horrific form themselves, they always seem to raise it against the English, especially at home. Yeah. They really won't want to lose at home to us. Yeah, I think they'll have to improve, otherwise they're going to lose.
Chris, what do you think?
No, I think that everyone's pretty bang on, to be honest. I think even though Wales did have a pretty cagey affair with Italy, they still showed that they are able to do enough. And, you know, I think in the end they kind of pummeled Italy towards the end, even though Italy put up a really good fight towards the start of it. But I think England did look quite suspect, it's got to be said, against France, you know, a team that we, you know, all said last week we didn't expect to do very well. I thought France actually played really well, to be honest. And I have to admit, I thought England, they didn't win, they more survived more than anything. I think it was like Ben Teo's try, and it didn't feel like a celebration, it felt more like relief.
Isn't that a sign of a really good team, though? We always say that in football, when they can win ugly. Isn't that a sign of a really good team?
Yeah, it is. Well, the streak's still going on.
15,
so, yeah.
It's 15 in a row, which is now a record, to be fair to them. So that's a pretty impressive thing to be holding. But I'm worried. I'm just going to say that, because considering how Wales in that game against Italy, you know, they hadn't scored a point in the entire. They were going at the end of the first half behind, hadn't scored a point, 7-0 down, and then they roared back 33-7 in the second half, and they're going to be pumped up after that. They're going to feel really confident, thinking that, well, we can turn this game around. We can turn games around now when we're away. They're at home against England, which is a daunting enough prospect as it is for England facing any Welsh team there, but one that's just bounced back so strongly. I mean, yeah, okay, sorry, perspective, they are bouncing back against Italy, not the strongest teams. I mean, if it was Ireland, that would be amazing, the score which they did, but it's worrying for England, and it's going to probably leave. I think Eddie Jones, he said that he was concerned by it. He said that, you know, it's always good when you win well, even if you don't play well, but he did admit that he was concerned by the performance against France.
Yes, so we're going to move back to the Scotland game now. We're just going to talk about how big a result that was for them. Chris, what are your thoughts on that game?
I thought Scotland were brilliant. You know, they were absolutely superb. And Ireland just kept knocking the door in the second half. And it's amazing, actually, Scotland didn't concede more points. I thought just the defence's resilience was just phenomenal. And you're right, there was that split second when you thought, oh no, have Ireland actually done enough to win this? And then Scotland wins the penalties. And then Greg Laidlaw, really calm under pressure, doing the job, and winning for Scotland, really, but I think it was rightly deserved. In that first half, they were absolutely brilliant, tore Ireland to shreds. Ireland didn't really have much of an answer. You could say that Ireland did look a bit suspect, it's got to be said. But I'm just interested to see how Scotland will physically recover from such a strong win against Ireland, because literally they threw bodies on the line there. You know, will they be able to like physically prepare themselves up for this weekend's games? It'll have to be seen, but you know, I think Ireland will come back from this strongly. You know, we saw how good they were in that second half.
Well, Ireland have Italy up next, and you'd very much expect them to win that. Well, an interesting game we've got is France versus Scotland. Scotland with a big win at the weekend, and then France with a last few minutes defeat against England. Joe, what do you think for that game?
I can't see anything other than a France win.
Oh, boring.
Yeah, great.
Oh, come on, Joe.
You know, it was mentioned then about the toll it might have taken on the Scotland players to beat Ireland, which was a massive win. I actually thought Ireland would... I thought it was going to be an England-Ireland shootout in the last game of the tournament, but now the group's wide open. Yeah. But no, I'd be extremely surprised if they beat France, but they beat Ireland, so you never know.
Mm. Okay, anyone else on that?
I'm just going to say, with France, I mean, I've said this before, but France are France. You never know which French team's going to turn up. The one that turned up against England was strong, resilient, very well-disciplined, and it pushed England very hard and visibly frustrates a lot of the England team. You know, Mike Brown especially, you could see at the back, he was really getting wound up in that game. But there is another French team which sometimes turns up, which is one which just has an argument amongst itself, capitulates, can't string a decent run of passes together and collapse. And if that one turns up, although Scotland will probably still be carrying on a bit of exhaustion from the Ireland game, I think Scotland could potentially beat them. So it's going to be very dependent on the mindset I think the French go into it. The other game, Ireland, Italy. I mean, if Ireland don't win that, then they need to really have a long, hard look at themselves if they don't win that game.
Yeah, so we're going to go around the room. Predictions for the three games, Chris? Italy,
dear.
Ireland, who's going to win that?
It's got to be Ireland, really, hasn't it? I can't really see Italy doing enough to beat Ireland. I think as well, like, the loss to Scotland will rejuvenate them, and I fully expect them to, you know, kind of walk over Italy. Yeah.
So Jeremy's already said Ireland for that. Naomi, any thoughts on rugby?
No. I would agree that Ireland will beat Italy. I don't know that much about rugby, and I'll say that one. England, it's going to be tough. Not really sure which way that will go.
And then finally, Joe.
Yeah, I think Ireland have probably put a few points past him as well.
And then England, do you reckon, guys? Do you reckon we'll win? What are you calling that one?
I can't. I'd like to think England, but you just don't know. Like, it will be tight. The run has to end, and Eddie Jones has admitted that it will end sometime in the Six Nations. If it was to be against Wales at home, then I think that's the game that of all of them you'd expect to lose, really. But then again, I'm going to say England, actually.
Okay, nice one. And that's all of our Rugby Union chat for this evening. We'll be back next week with some more Rugby Union after those weekend's results.
When I'm completely wrong.
Hopefully, yeah, so I can slate you. No, we're going to move on to the Davis Cup now, and Naomi's got a report on the weekend's action.
Disqualification for Canada leads Great Britain to the quarterfinal of the Davis Cup after Shapovalov accidentally hit the umpire with the tennis ball in anger after being broken in the third set. The match finished 6-3, 6-4, 2-1 to Kyle Edmund, sealing the victory for Great Britain 3-2. Edmund and Evans managed to do the damage as Murray is taking the month out for rest. The quarterfinal will be played in France, which could be very challenging for the Brits. But if Murray is playing, then I like to think we will always have a chance.
Okay. So it was a good win in the end, but there's only one place we can really start, isn't it? And, well, do you think it was right for the disqualification to happen?
Yes, definitely. I'll say that straight away, because you can't do that. Yes, Shapovalov is 17 years old, but it doesn't make it okay. Yes, it was an accident, but it still doesn't make it okay. He hit the ball in anger. Wherever it went, it's not good. But to hit the umpire, you think you're safe sitting up there, but nowhere safe on the tennis court, it seems. So disqualification seems only fair.
Yeah, I think rules are rules. I think had he not been disqualified and he wanted to turn it around against Edmund, I think Britain would have been a bit miffed.
That's true. It was only really, we saw it quite lightly because Edmund was two sets up at the time. So, yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting. As the guys have said, rules are rules. So I don't. Well, even when he hit the ball, he just kind of knew the game's up, really, isn't it?
It's one of those things you just regret straight away.
Yeah, no, exactly. like his face literally just dropped when he hit. It's like, oh no.
And well, he was fined to add to the disqualification. I can't remember how much, but
I think it was about 7,000. Of some form of currency, I can't remember which one.
Zimbabwean
dollars. He's not going to do it again, so I think the lesson will be learned.
And that's the main thing. That's kind of the key thing. I mean, he's 17, he's young. I mean, he'll blame that probably the fact that people will say, oh, he's hot-headed, he'll just lash out. Well, if he's done that, he's going to learn now. You don't hit out the ball hanger, and you especially don't aim it at the umpire or the referee. I mean, it's of everyone to hit, I mean, it's comedy gold. Come on.
We've all done it, though. Been frustrated over a sport, and he was just in the wrong, hit it in the wrong place. Yeah.
It was a good shot, it has to be said. Like, but literally gone
spot on
the
face.
I do feel his pain, though, because tennis, I play a bit of tennis, and it is the most frustrating sport in the world, because it's literally you on your own. It's you against someone else. And, you make a mistake, and it's literally on you. And, I can't keep my frustration intact when it comes to tennis either, so I do feel his pain, but... Yeah, rules are rules.
So, moving on, Naomi, how good was Dan Evans over the weekend?
Dan Evans played very well. I was surprised. He was attacking the ball. He got a lot of good shots. His serve was also quite impressive. So, I think he can improve. He's doing well for Britain.
He's had a good start to 2017 as well. He was in the Aussie Open fourth round. I think he got to the final of an ATP tournament as well. So, he's had a really good start. We'll have to move on to Kyle Edmund as well, who's had a bit of a disappointing start. He had a disappointing loss in the first game, didn't he?
Yep, he lost against...
Pospisil,
that's the one. I think he should have won. I mean, Pospisil is alright, but I think Kyle Edmund should be beating him based on how well he was doing at the end of last year. If he carried on the form, then I would have seen Edmund winning that game before the match.
Yeah, I think we've had a pretty bad start to 2017, hasn't he, Joe?
Kyle Edmund?
Yes.
Yeah, his form's dipped a bit, but I think he's definitely a player for the future. I think it's good. I mean, I think there's a bit more going on in British tennis at the moment. It's not just Andy Murray. For Dan Evans to put out Cilic, who'd won the Australian Open before, losing the fourth round, was a great effort. I think Kyle Edmund, how old is he, 23, is he?
Something like that?
22, yeah. He's got so much time on his side. And he'll be learning from all his defeats. And I think for Britain to win without Andy Murray was great as well.
So. Also, I think the fact that they're playing on the same team as Andy Murray means that they can look up to him, and he's definitely a leader for them, so that will help them to improve in the future.
100% agree with that. But moving on to Murray, was it right for him to sit out the tournament?
You've got to say, probably fair. I mean, Murray has played the Davis Cup 2 years in a row. I think the Australian Open, he probably was a shock defeat, and these things happen, but he'd probably argue he was a bit tired. He'd been playing literally all year round, and I've got zero problem with Murray saying, I need a rest, because I think his schedule has just been ridiculous. I think he plays more games than anyone else in the world, so fair enough in my opinion.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think as well, you just see his schedule from 2016, where he had the Olympics, had the Davis Cup the year before when he won the Davis Cup, when he was... giving his all, and I think to agree with Joe, really, I think it is fair enough. But also I think the loss to the Australian Open in such early rounds as well would have made him need to readjust something going into the French Open, so I think it's fair. I think it's completely understandable him dropping out.
I think Naomi might have a differing opinion there.
Oh, here we go.
I'm not sure, but because he went out quite early on in the Australian Open, I think he had some time to recover before the Davis Cup, so could have played. And I think it's just saying something that other top players are not as interested, because the Davis Cup it's like the World Cup for tennis, so it should be quite a key tournament. And if the players are just resting, are they that interested? It brings up that question, because there are other times in the year where he can miss out tournaments and rest. Because he was out quite early on in the Australian Open, I think that he should have played personally.
My next question was, how is the competition affected by these big names sitting out? Because Canada obviously had Milos Raonic sitting out as well. And Jeremy, how do you think the tournament is affected by this?
I think
It's interesting, really, because I think with Murray, for example, sitting out, I mean, the plus side we can say is, well, you know, it gives other people besides Murray the chance to step into the spotlight and have their moments and also to play really well. But I think if it was on the flip side and we'd lost, I think there would then be criticism hurled at Murray for, well, why didn't you play when your country needs you? Why didn't you take part in the Davis Cup? So I think the fact that some of the big names, when they sit out, a lot of people can't, I mean, for example, looking at the big ones of Federer, Nadal, Djokovic and Murray, for example.
Wawrinka was out of this tournament as well.
Wawrinka as well. You know, when they sit out of it, yeah, it gives other people the chance to, you know, enjoy the tournaments and to partake, but it also kind of costs some of the interest, because those people that might just be sort of looking at tennis, really focusing on the big four and wanting to see those four when they clash with each other, which is a massive pull for a lot of, you know, people that don't have a huge interest in the sport, don't follow it as much as other people. It costs these guys actually their attention, because if Murray had been on that team, say, and, you know, if Murray's on that team, for example, I think they would have probably got more people watching it, more people would have been engaged in it, what then the position when he's out. So it's weird. It kind of puts, it's this weird limbo where it's good in one way, but it's really quite damning for the tournament in the other.
Yeah, I think to follow on from what Jeremy was saying, it is really interesting how these big players don't seem to be as interested in the Davis Cup. And I think because ultimately tennis players are remembered not for really the Davis Cup, they're more remembered for how many Grand Slams they've won. And I think if you were to ask Andy Murray what's your focus now, he would say the French Open. But I think also it works nicely, and I think as well for the coaching staff, if they were really worried about us losing to Canada, I think they would have actually been like, no, Andy Murray, you're playing for us. But I think if anything, it's a testament to actually like how good our strength and depth is. We have got Kyle Edmund, we have got Dan Evans, who can do the job when required, but also as well because we know that Canada's not going to play someone like Milos Raonic, we could then say to Andy Murray, no, it's fine, you could take a breather, focus on the French Open, we've got things from here. So because we know that these other countries aren't going to play their big players, it means we allow Andy Murray to focus on his ultimate objective, which I think would be to win more Grand Slams.
How much is these big players missing out to do with the schedule, though? I mean, this has come a week after the Australian Open final, and I think the next round's scheduled just after Wimbledon or something, and they can't keep...
The next round's in April,
I believe. Oh, sorry, I think the round after that's scheduled straight after Wimbledon, and they surely can't get the tennis they want to be played in these matches if they're coming straight after big Grand Slam tournaments. Anyone?
Yeah. I was just thinking, like, maybe in that case, that's sort of a problem then, really, with, in a way, the tennis itself's organisation. I mean, it's only natural, in a way, for Federer and Nadal, specifically now after their epic five-set match that they had, that they're not going to be wanting to partake because they are going to need time to recover. Nadal, especially because, obviously, the French Open coming up, that's the one he wants to win.
Play season, yeah.
That's where he's going to, like, focus on trying to win back another Grand Slam if he's going to this year at all, realistically. But the fact that they keep falling after the major tournaments is really a problem with the organisation, but it's also a kind of unfortunate issue because it's going to have to fall in between each round, but does it have to fall so close to them is the thing, which is the real question.
And then I think the problem as well is they've also got other smaller competitions like the Doha Open, the Dubai Open, Queens as well, building up to Wimbledon. So yeah, Andy Murray could potentially have Queens, then Wimbledon, and then the Davis Cup quarterfinals or semifinals. He is participating in Queens again, yeah. So it just, again, just adds more time up for, you know, these players like Andy Murray. But then I guess you could argue, like, what about, you know, people like Dan Evans, who would be potentially even doing more games than Andy Murray, but not winning as many games, but, you know, maybe a similar schedule. But it doesn't help, I think, in terms of the schedule, like having them so close. But then again, how else would you do it?
Maybe reduce the amount of times it's played, so every 2 years, every 4 years, like a World Cup of tennis maybe.
Yeah, that would probably raise more interest in it. That would probably definitely get, I think, more of the bigger names involved in it. And then something like, for example, that's coming around every single year, you know, some of the players might think, oh, well, I'll just sit this one out and I'll focus on the next one. Well, you don't really, like Naomi said, you don't really want them to be doing that. You know, this is the equivalent in tennis terms of a World Cup, really. And you want your big players to be up for taking part in it rather than, in a way, you know, on a patriotic side for, you know, representing their country and playing on behalf of them, not just playing for their own individual accolades and records. Like, obviously, well, not obviously, but like a lot of them do realistically. I mean, Federer, for example, is going to go down so far with 18 Grand Slams, the greatest, until someone beats him, and that's going to be a hell of a record for him to achieve. But he hasn't ever particularly cut it that much, the Davis Cup. I think he's participated in it quite a few times, to his credit.
I think Switzerland has won it once.
Yeah, they have won it once, but I mean, given the fact that they've got Federer, Wawrinka, you know, they have a really, they had a star team, and the fact is Federer just sort of kind of looks like he half the time is interested, half the time he just he's got better things to do.
Yeah,
I think with the Davis Cup, the problem is, you know, you talk about sort of the World Cup of tennis. Well, the difference is with the World Cup sort of in football is that it's played over a couple of weeks period. Well, the problem with the Davis Cup is that it's sort of played every few months, and you sort of forget about it for a few months, and we've got a Davis Cup match, and I don't know. I don't know if they could ever do anything like maybe have a block where it is played, where Davis Cup tennis is played for a few weeks or something like that. But yeah, I think they have to do something about it, because the interest of the players clearly isn't there.
And the fans, I think. Yeah.
Oh, I think the fans are great for the Davis Cup. You know, they're so
we've
animated.
Got fans,
yeah, we've got great fans. Yeah, just like there's always that one person with the horn, isn't it? Yeah,
I feel sorry for the fans though, because the fans want to see the top players. Yeah. The fans pay money to go to these matches. There's a great atmosphere there. I've never been. I really want to go. And I think they want to see the top players. Obviously, they enjoy it when they're watching whoever's playing represent their country. They want the country to win. But obviously, they'd rather see Andy Murray than Carl Edmund. That goes without saying.
Okay, so to end that debate there, because I think we could go on for a very long time about that, I'm just going to ask you about the next round, and then we'll finish it. The tennis talk there. So we're playing France in April. Naomi, I'll come to you first. How do you reckon that one will go?
It will be tough, depending on who France plays. They've got Songer, they've got Monfils, they've got Gasquet. They've got a good bunch of players. We've got Andy Murray, Evans, and Carl Edmund. So depending on if Murray plays, it could go either way. I hope we win. I think we will. If Murray plays, I think we'll win. If not, then I'll be worried.
They've also got one of the best doubles pairing in the world with Mahou and Pierre Hughes, Herbert, whatever his name is, I can't remember. Yeah. Does anyone else have any?
Yeah, I think France have got a lot of strength in depth. Obviously, again, it depends on the team they put out, but we've got a good side. I think if Andy Murray doesn't play, it could be curtains, judging on the French side, judging how many good players they've got. But, you know, we've got three good singles players if Andy Murray does play, and then we've got Jamie Murray, who will play with Andy Murray, and Jamie Murray doesn't seem to lose many doubles matches anymore, so I think we're with a great chance if DeLong we put out a good side.
Chris, final word?
I think it will be interesting, because I think it really does depend on whether or not who will admit that their star player will be playing, whether or not Song, you know, France will be admitting first that, oh yeah, Song will be playing, because then that'll mean to GB, right, Andy Murray, we actually need you right now. But if like one of the big French players don't play, then I think Andy Murray may be afforded like the miss. But because it is quarterfinal time, I think Andy Murray will be there, to be honest. And if he is, then I see the tie going to GB.
Okay, awesome. That's the end of the Davis Cup chat. And now we're on to our final topic of this revised Tuesday sports show. We're over to Joe with the big cricket news yesterday.
Yeah, the cricket news is that Alistair Cook has stepped down as England captain. I think it was quite predictable. After the defeat to India, it was 4-0. And it's taken so long for Cook to make a decision. I think the writing was on the wall. I think Joe Root is the outstanding candidate to take over. I can't really see anyone else who's Stuart Broad, but I think it'll be Root. They'll give him the summer and then he'll have the Ashes. It's not a surprise to me. I think Alistair Cook was certainly a great captain. I'd say he was a great sort of leader. He led by example. He was very dignified. But was he a great tactician? No. Probably not. And I think the timing probably was right to make a change.
Okay, so now Alistair Cook has resigned. Do you reckon, guys, we'll see a more relaxed Alistair Cook who will score runs more freely now with the
burden? I hope so. I mean, I personally always think that the England captaincy is a massive curse, really, to whichever gets it, especially if it's a batsman. I mean, the biggest and most famous example is Botham. Obviously, when he had it, he went from arguably England's looked like he was going to smash every record England had, then a few years of real decline, and he looked a shadow of the player he used to be. Famously, he was booed off at Lord. Well, he was booed and hissed off at Lords, which he then said as a result he never saluted Lords again because of how he felt betrayed by that. And he then afterwards researched his career very well. And I think for Cook, hopefully for him, you know, now that he's not got the burden of captaincy on his shoulders, he can concentrate on his game. He can concentrate on getting backs. Before he took the captaincy, he was hitting some incredible numbers for England every time. And he was one of those players we could always depend on. Looking though on like as to who can replace him, personally I'd rather see either Stuart Broad, maybe Jimmy Anderson as well, possibly. I mean, those are two players that have been in the team a long time. Root obviously is a player for the now and also for the future, but it's just that worry I have. I don't want Root to suddenly be getting the captaincy and then falling so far from the amazing player that he is. And I mean, I think arguably England's best captain we've had for, I'd say, in the last 10 years, well, more than that, probably, I'd say the last 15 years was Michael Vaughan, because Vaughan knew how to handle it and how to act as the captain. Strauss struggled a lot, we saw. Morgan is a very good potential shout, which I think he should be allowed a chance, even though, of course, he's focusing entirely on ODI. But, I mean, I'm optimistic for Cook. I hope it helps him now, but I think someone like Stuart Broad or Jimmy Anderson, who's been in the team a long time, who knows the team well, and who arguably they're starting to already naturally decline. Anderson's numbers have been dropping off recently, so they haven't quite got the pressure. They have to keep that really high level anymore. They're sort of in the period where it's now a natural kind of, well, we're not going to do as well. We can focus maybe more on helping the team and not just ourselves.
Yeah, there does seem to be this curse, doesn't there? And I think even when you look at someone like Michael Vaughan, who was, you know, by far England's best batsman, and then he became captain, and then the numbers weren't quite as good. You could say
Strauss as well.
Strauss as well, exactly. And then Alistair Cook, you know, you just see what he did in Australia in 2010-11. The numbers he put against India, he nearly got the 300. And then even just beforehand, like, I know we had a pretty dire performance against South Africa, but still, Cook looked quite decent, and then was given the captaincy, and he was just never able to reach those forms of, you know, batting quality or peak of batting again, you know. If anything, actually, I have to admit, like, given the run, because Cook is actually now England's leading run scorer, I'm surprised he didn't do it earlier, to be honest, just because, you know, his scores have actually kind of dwindled a bit.
I think the fact they didn't do it earlier was a great thing, because I think had he given Joe Root the captaincy going to India,
yeah,
that would
have
been
exactly
a pretty chastening experience.
Yeah,
to get trounced,
because
with the best captain in the world, we would have got battered in India.
Yeah.
It wasn't down to Cook's captaincy; it was down to the fact that we can't play spin or bowl spin,
which has been a problem since Graham Swan. Really, haven't had a set spinner in the team for ages. I mean, it's something we on URN I think have gone over time and time again. We need a spinner.
Yeah, hopefully Jack Leach will.
Yeah,
maybe.
Now he's stolen actions back. But going back to Cook, I think there's a bit of pressure on him to score a shedload of runs in Australia, because the main thing coming out of his captaincy resignation is that if he goes back to scoring the runs that he did when we won down under, when we won 3-1 there, when he scored a ridiculous amount of runs, well, we've got every chance of winning the series there. But if Cook comes in and he's not been in poor form, but he's not scoring the big runs that we know. So there's a lot of pressure on Cook to score big runs again now. So
saying it like with any cricketer, when you sort of say, oh, you know, when they've got 100 runs, that's usually something which we really look at as a real, you know, achievement. But with Cook, I remember like every time it sort of looks as, you know, when he's hitting, when he gets into like the mid 70s or the 80s, and everyone says, oh, actually he might be able to get another century this time, it's sort of the dread of, actually, is he going to be able to do it? And then he then falls flat, and it's an, oh, well, no, of course he's not. I mean, he seemed to have struggled so much over the last few years, and I think that obliteration that we got in the home Ashes a few years ago when Johnson tore England apart, really. I think that Australia, of course, not in England, but I think that shattered his confidence as a team. It also broke the team apart, obviously. I mean, we saw Graham Swan jump ship.
I think he was very close to resigning after the Sri Lanka series, after the Ashes, when we lost at home. And he could have easily gone then, but as you say, Joe, he didn't really
have any candidates.
He
was never quite the same. I think he's admitted this today with an interview, say, after the Kevin Peterson affair, which happened after the South Africa test series at home, when the sort of certain sections of the media, never mind the team, sort of never got behind him ever again. And I think Cook's felt a little bit betrayed by that, and also the ECB. But now he's not captain, hopefully he'll be able to free himself up.
Hopefully. But yeah, no, it's interesting, the whole South Africa incident, because then like Strauss left, and then Alistair Cook was actually quite prominent, I believe, in getting Peterson out of the team. But hopefully now that he has lost the captaincy, he will be able to, yeah, just relax a bit and just do what he used to do so well for England, just get, you know, runs and just like focus on that. Now he doesn't really have to focus on the fielding aspect. Actually, one thing I thought was really interesting actually was just towards the end of Strauss's years, they would actually start playing Alistair Cook in slip, mm-hmm. which was unnatural for him, because that's a standard captain's position and he's not a natural slip. He's made a good position of it now, but he was always touted as being like the next England captain, and I think we have to be careful with someone like Joe Root, because obviously he is our best batsman, and risking losing our best batsman because of the pressures of the captaincy, you know, I'd personally see someone like Stuart Broad get over Joe Root, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, saying that though, of course, I mean, it just on this, because we sound like we are digging into Cook a little bit, just to bring
it
back.
Oh, he's still amazing.
I was about to say, just bring it back onto looking at it actually on retrospect. When we've said all the issues though, of course, that he has to deal with, the Peterson affair, the demolition down under, the loss of Graham Swann, of course, the kind of rebuilding transition job that England are currently under, where we're trying to get the young blood into the team, and we're really trying to build this up. If we're looking actually as to how he's handled stuff off the pitch and how he's actually kind of kept the squad together and brought them through this time, he's a really great captain in that respect. On the pitch, he'll always be questioned for the fact he's not really so far been able to keep up those numbers he started so early on. But I mean, I think he'll probably go down as, unfortunately, one of those kind of underrated and forgotten captains when we think of like the great ones that England has had throughout the years, because it's the way he's dealt with a team in crisis for so long, and he could have shirked the burden, he could have dropped the captaincy and given it to someone else, but he carried on, and like the guys have said, you know, he seems to have got to the point now where it's kind of, he's not got anywhere else to go, he doesn't feel that...
He's just drained, isn't he?
Yeah, he can take it any further without seriously damaging the team.
But also, he's claimed some incredible test victories himself as captain.
We won in India.
We won in India, exactly. We also won in South Africa as well.
It was a great win as well.
And we had a fantastic run in the Ashes as well.
So yeah, he's got a mixed record. You know, we drew series, we lost to them to Sri Lanka, we drew in West Indies, which are two pretty horrendous results. But then, on the flip side, he has got some amazing results on his belt as well. I mean, that one in India especially. I mean, when we went to South Africa, it was a great win, but it was against a bit of a decline in South Africa's side. The two Australian wins were against
Australian side, matches, I'd say.
Yeah, they were two Australian teams that haven't been the strongest we've ever seen.
Yeah, Ponson was on his way out.
Sorry to cut you off there. Yeah, just to finish it off, I want one word answers. Who will be England's next captain? We'll go to Chris first.
Does it have to be one word?
Well, you've already wasted your quota.
Oh, no.
Go for it.
I was going to say Root, but I wouldn't give it to him personally, but it will be Root.
Okay, Jeremy?
Preferably, I'd say Anderson. I know he's not going to get it. I'd say Broad.
And then Naomi, if you want to go.
Root, just because he's the vice-captain and it just seems likely that he will take over.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks, guys. And, of course, if you want to hear some more stuff on Alistair Cook and cricket in general, me and Joe are recording a cricket podcast with some other people, and it's called Sticky Wicket, and we'll be recording that at some point this week. So thanks for listening, guys. We should be back on air on Thursday evening with Jeremy. I think you're on that. Are you on that this week?
The Thursday Sports Show. I don't know. I probably might end up being on it.
Jeremy, you might hear Jeremy's beautiful voice again. We'll be back on Saturday, and of course Tuesday Sport next week. So thanks, guys, and thanks for listening.